Peoples of the universe, please attend carefully. The podcast that follows is TV Cream Countdown. The 50 greatest Doctor Who moments. This is the first of five episodes, all devoted to that meddling misfit, the Doctor, on the occasion of his 50th birthday. 50! You're getting old, Doctor. Middle-aged, even. Ha! I predict a jacket and jeans ensemble for your Peter Capaldi incarnation. But enough gloating. Let us hear a sample of what TV Cream have prepared.
Welcome to you from the Time Lord.
I think I see the answer. You are from the British Narcotics.
Hello? Hello?
Am I right?
Hello? Hello, who is this?
There are some corners of the universe which have read the most terrible things.
For the purposes of the next few minutes, think of me as Professor Judson to TV Cream's Finland.
And I haven't taken receipt of any more books.
If you have any problem,
TV Cream were quite mean to me about
drop
it.
Drop us a line about it, and we'll get your Cream's answer back.
It's not a cube!
And now, bring forth the podcast.
And so, at the behest of the Master, the countdown of the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments gets underway. At number 50, we ask, who's your who?
There are real difficulties in attempting to divine who your who is. Is it merely the who was there when you started watching? But what if that who was the who was in the various repeat runs of old stories, while another who was actually the who was who at the time? Well, what if you missed the last who before who came back, and relied entirely on an old who before the new who started? Does that make the new who your who, or should you stick with the who you saw first? Or is there some canonical law that dictates which who is your who, that those who don't know who canon, well, don't know about? Who knows? Well, maybe the safest thing to do at this point is to recap just who are the Whos. But this is an important point. How to lend it sufficient weight? Well, let's try this.
One man, 12 actors, 50 years. William Hartnell, like sitting next to a scary old man on a cosmic bus. Patrick Troughton, mad as a fish. John Pertwee, arrant nonsense. Tom Baker, all teeth and curls. Peter Davidson, he's off to Button Moon to kill Daleks. Colin Baker, underrated. Sylvester McCoy, better on Tiswas. Paul McGann, timing malfunction, not off. Christopher Eccleston, run for your life. David Tennant, just kill the monsters. Matt Smith, we don't want him to go. Which is ironic, really. Peter Capaldi, insert your Malcolm Tucker joke here. So, ladies and gentlemen, who's your who?
There you go then. That's who they are. Now, who's my who? Well, for myself, there are a couple of possibilities. I was born in 1975, so does that make Tom Baker my who? Because he was there from the point of conception. Well, not literally, of course. I don't know.
Hello. I'm called the Doctor.
But then when I hit optimum viewing age, which I'm entirely arbitrarily fixing at 8 years old, Peter Davison had taken over. So there's a real case that he's my who.
After all, that's how it all started.
I was certainly The Five Doctors is my favourite story, but that hardly helps. They're all bloody in that.
Splendid fellows, all of you.
Well, let's just draw a discreet veil over Herndl.
It changes nothing. Absolutely nothing.
But since one of the favourite pastimes of hooligans is to argue over who was the best who, an exercise I'm only too happy to take part in, I couldn't in all conscience say that old Leek Lapels himself is my favourite. which probably doesn't make him my who. Or does it? Well, maybe it's out of my hands.
It's out of our hands now.
So it occurs that the normal practice is to have two who's. One who was there when you hit an age of being able to choose to watch the programme for yourself, and that does rather hark back to a time when you had to actually state a cogent argument and put a case in order to clonk the button on the big higher telly in the living room, so apologies to listeners who had a telly in their bedrooms in recent years, flash gets. And another who you pick in retrospect. And for that, well, let's read Tom Baker or Pat Troughton.
Who does he think he is?
Because let's face it, no one picks Colin.
You're expecting someone else?
So have we answered the question, who's your who? Or how do you pick your who? Or who do you do? Well, no, we haven't.
Something's wrong, you know.
But that's probably because, like most things to do with popular children's television programme Doctor Who, the fun is in the question rather than the answer.
Number 49. It's complicated. Well,
one of the greatest pleasures you can have as a Doctor Who fan is nitpicking the idly curious questions posed by mundanes. Occasionally one of them will ask you, how many Doctor Who's have there been? I went to the doctor and the good doctor said... So, you have to tell them, there haven't been any Doctor Who's, that's the name of the programme. You never refer to it as a show, it's always the programme. His name is The Doctor. You gotta slow down your life before you go. And so then they'll restate their question as, so how many doctors have there been? But do they mean on-screen doctors? Are they counting Richard Herndl or the badly running second doctor as seen in the most recent series finale? And what about Trevor Martin, Peter Cushing, The Watcher, Nick Briggs? Then there's the brain of Morbius, the stuntmen, body doubles, Jim Broadbent twice, Rupert Booth, Sylvester McCoy. The truth is, and it's a brilliant truth, there is very little that is straightforward about Doctor Who. Stand and face it, life is so complicated. Even its essential facts are about as difficult to nail to a wall as a gel guard or a gelf. And let's not even try to grapple with the Blinovich limitation effect.
You tell me, I've no idea.
The how many doctors question cannot be satisfactorily answered by numerics alone, and it's just as difficult to tie down how many companions there have been.
The last of the Time Lords and his travelling machine. Or with his little human girl from long ago.
What constitutes a companion? What classification can you devise that includes Liz Shaw, patently a companion, but excludes Adam Mitchell, patently not a companion?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Time travel.
And then there's canon and canonicity. It's as complicated as pie, and is the dark secret at the heart of Time Lord society. Sorry, Doctor Who fandom. How can determining what is and isn't part of the story be so difficult? When Jesus Christ made a guest appearance alongside Superman in issue 190 of DC Comics' Brave and the Bold, there was probably little or no debate as to whether this therefore made Mr. Mixius Pidlick part of official New Testament continuity.
It's Mix. Yes.
Similarly, Noel Edmonds is clearly not canonical in the eyes of It Ain't Half Hot Mum fans.
Hey boys.
That, despite his intrusion into their world on an episode of Swap Shop. So, where are the boundaries and certainties of Doctor Who? We can't say who he is, or how many of them there have been, or even if they've all been he's. We can't classify who or what constitutes a companion. We cannot, with complete accuracy, even provide you with the correct story titles for all of his adventures. Or confirm whether or not Frank Butcher is actually part of the Hooniverse. Although if he is, how do we explain the Pauline Fowler still being alive in 2013 anomaly as propagated by Dimensions in Time? If we can't quantify much about Doctor Who, at least we can explain why this is so. Unlike Harry Potter or The Lord of the Rings or even Star Trek, at least back in the day, Doctor Who knows no singular creator. It's a show that's been fashioned by a succession of staff producers and writers on their way from a story editor gig on Emergency War 10 and soon to be departing for a producership on Shoestring. Right. Doctor Who isn't precision built from the ground up. The truth is that Telly's greatest ever programme is a bit of a bodge job, with narrative and conceptual fault lines papered over or unnoticed until much later. But, as is the case with Patrick Troughton's craggy old face, it's those lines of visible wear and tear spidering out in ever greater multiplicities that make Doctor Who the idiosyncratic and unique programme we know, love, and nitpick today.
Number 48. Keeping the British End Up.
A sexual flaneur and an asexual flaneller. For half a century, the UK has been represented around the globe by these two utterly unrepresentative archetypes, and has relished almost every minute of it.
My name's Bond.
Oh, you're Mr. Bond. I believe I'm having you in half an hour.
Oh, splendid. Your room or mine?
James Bond and Doctor Who have become Britannia's cultural forts. And what a pair of old forts they are. If Bond is a Union Jack tied to a hard-on, Doctor Who is a used tea bag on a kitchen sideboard. Both tickle the fancy, sometimes, say the 1970s, uproariously. At other times, the 1980s, bafflingly. They've shared the same obsession with diabolical masterminds bent on planetary domination, with dry wit and loose morals, with underground lairs and floating palaces and computers made up of big reels of tape rotating one way and then the other, and with getting away with it again and again and again. Most notably by passing off recastings and sackings and cancellation crises as a rebooting or a hiatus or something from which the franchise will return bigger and better than ever. But there's another connection, a shared cast of actors who are able to boast not one but two lines on their CV that can guarantee admission to a fan convention. Julian Glover tops the list, thanks to managing a gap of just 2 years between his scene-stealing performances in the 1979 Doctor Who story City of Death.
My dear, I don't think he's as stupid as he seems.
My dear, nobody could be as stupid as he seems.
And his scene-scuttling performances in the 1981 Bond film For Your Eyes Only.
I think I see the answer. You are from the British Narcotics Board. Am I right?
Go on.
There's Anthony Ainley, master of innuendo in You Only Live Twice in 1967.
Well, at least he died on the job. He'd have wanted it this way.
And just plain the Master in Doctor Who for the whole of the 1980s.
I know this is going to be hard to believe, Doctor, but for once I mean you no harm. Like Alice, I try to believe three impossible things before breakfast.
Geoffrey Palmer has been killed three times in Doctor Who to date, but arguably suffered a worse fate in the Bond film Tomorrow Never Dies, skewered on the end of a barbed retort from Judi Dench.
With all due respect, Em, sometimes I don't think you have the balls for this job.
Perhaps. The advantage is I don't have to think with them all the time.
The formula is sequel 007.
There's Bernard Cribbins, about the only good thing in David Tennant's final stories as Doctor Who, who was also
a reluctant traveller into the dangerous future.
That was the second and best Doctor Who big screen spin-off, plus a reluctant cabbie in the first and best Casino Royale.
Where to?
Berlin.
East or west?
West, of course.
Oh, well, that's all right then.
And let's not forget Fraser Hines, the companion Jamie in Doctor Who and in James Bond.
You only live twice. Two of the villains, they were kind of Chinese-looking, but they couldn't understand their accent. So all our voices, stop that astronaut. Clear the area. T minus counting and 10, 9, 2, stop the astronaut. That's me.
Finally, the only actual Doctor Who to have appeared in an actual Bond film. That's actual in your actual unofficial Doctor Who in your actual unofficial Bond film. But one had the actual TARDIS, and the other had the actual Sean Connery. And whatever you think of The Curse of Fatal Death or Never Say Never Again, you can't take that away from them. If only that were true of Rowan Atkinson.
He fears for the security of the civilized world.
Never again.
Number 47, Beryl.
Attention, Earthlings. This podcast is now the dominion of the Cybermen. You will listen to our broadcast. You will listen at once. In your Earth year 1982, we return to your visual screens in a Doctor Who story designated Earthshock. It had been 7 Terran years since we last appeared in the Children's Own television series that adults adore. During the intervening period, cyber technology had been brushing up on both our pronunciation...
And you, Doctor, and your two friends will help us in this task.
And our new shiny helmets. When we emerged from that interregnum, we came to realize that there are some corners of the universe which have bred the most terrible things. Things which act against everything we believe in. They must be fought. Nonetheless, Gary Downey did also make some exemplary contributions to Doctor Who.
Come on, let's make magic.
And his influence on the casting decisions made by the humanoid known as JNT...
The buck stops here.
...was excellent.
When it came to assigning an Earthling to the role of freighter ship Captain Briggs, JNT was unable to acquire his preferred Terran actress, Pat Phoenix.
Do you know, Willa, that's the first sensible thing you've said yet.
But still managed to allocate her hairstyle to the position. Under this carapace, he and Gary Downey then installed future grandmother to Adrian Mole. Beryl Reed.
So melodramatic.
Cybermen cannot modify their intonation. What you term as melodramatic is our standard conversational mode. To continue, some Doctor Who fans considered this casting decision illogical. However, Beryl Reed had prior outer space experience, having accompanied the lunar feline known as Mooncat on several low jeopardy adventures for Yorkshire Television's Get Up and Go.
As Captain Briggs, the aged humanoid actress subverted Earthling's expectations that a more vigorous protagonist should have been assigned to the role. However, we Cybermen contend that, had it been so, Briggs would have become merely a standard macho space female.
Indeed, we further reason that this seemingly illogical designation actually denotes the real genius of Doctor Who.
So do I, mister.
Excellent. We are in agreement then. No other TV series emanating from planet Earth would have made such a decision.
Oh, we're running out of time.
Agreed. This cyber unit is due to sit down to a well-prepared meal in 30 rels.
And so we conclude, in terms you Earthlings would comprehend, that the eccentric casting of Beryl Reed and the rationale behind it is in fact what makes Doctor Who such TV gold.
No! Gold! No!
What is happening? This unit has been compromised. Relinquishing command of the podcast. Tell Mother I will be late for supper. Advice. Cyber Command to roll end credits in silence.
Number 46, Ox into Infinity.
What's the difference between a story arc and a theme? Well, all shows have themes, whether that's a protracted exercise in snogging your way across the cosmos.
Space, a final frontier.
Getting dolled up to fight giant gorillas and lobsters armed to the teeth with missiles.
G-Force, five incredible young people with superpowers.
Or struggling to get home whilst avoiding a pasty-faced knobhead on a patent leather donkey.
Ranger? Barbarian? Magician? Thief? Cavalier? And acrobat?
But there's a difference between the basic premise of a show and the movement through a storyline that chimes with that premise. Well, most of the time.
It concerns the key to time. You know of the key to time?
Nope.
The key to time is a perfect cube.
It's not a cube.
Which maintains the equilibrium of time itself.
A cube?
It's not a cube.
It consists of six segments. And these segments are scattered and hidden throughout the cosmos. When they are assembled into the cube...
It's not a cube!
The key to time must have seemed like a good idea at the time for Doctor Who's 16th season. Find a strong story and hook the viewers for the whole season. I will leave you to decide for yourself if it was a good idea and whether it worked.
It's not a cube!
But the general consensus is that they didn't quite pull it off, no matter how many wicker garden chairs or decanters of Calvados were involved. It never attracted the same ire as this, though.
In all my travellings throughout the universe, I have battled against evil, against power-mad conspirators. I should have stayed here. The oldest civilization. Decadent, degenerate, and rotten to the core. Power mad conspirators, Daleks, Sontarans, Cybermen. They're still in the nursery compared to us.
Personally, we love the Trial of Time Lord season, and mostly because it is so absolutely barking.
They made a deal with the Valyard, or as I've always known him, the Doctor, to adjust the evidence.
Say what?
Silly robots, Joni Sims a mobile in a woolly smock, and the truly shocking moment, Perry's death.
You killed Perry?
We had to act.
But back in the day, story arcs weren't overly common for Doctor Who. Sure, there were running jokes and characters.
This is the Doctor. Brigadier there, please.
Yes, Doctor, go ahead.
And places to revisit.
A call. A call from Gallifrey. Gallifrey. After all this time.
But they took a new look to bring us story arcs into Infinity.
Bad Wolf.
Oh, aye.
Courtesy of the Bad Wolf Corporation.
Uh-huh.
Something called Bad Wolf Virus.
Virus?
Bad Wolf.
This is the Bad Wolf scenario.
What is?
Bad Wolf 1 descending. Bad Wolf 1 descending.
Right, that's a helicopter.
The big Bad Wolf.
Wheels?
Blythe Throog.
What's it mean?
Bad Wolf.
Oh, very Welsh all of a sudden.
And over on the Bad Wolf channel.
Blake 7, hopefully.
Bad Wolf. I've heard that lots of times.
Yeah, no shit. So when the show returned, no one expected anything other than a series of episodes with possibly a big flash finale. So when the whispers started to go out about Bad Wolf, it seemed impossibly exciting. It was the sort of viral chat that modern shows drool over. The problem is, did it actually make any sense? Did anything to do with Bad Wolf actually make any difference to what happened at the end of Eccles' series? I mean, wouldn't everything have happened pretty much exactly the way it turned out anyway?
Nah, just a coincidence.
Well, quite. I mean, did a wee gad spray-painting Bad Wolf on the side of the TARDIS, or some wee blue dick muttering about it into an Atmos mic really matter? Well, anyway, it was fun, it held our interest. Then, of course, it got silly.
The cracks in the skin of the universe, don't you know where they came from? The universe is cracked. The Pandorica will open. Silence will fall.
Yeah, we don't really know where to begin with all that. Story arcs are a fun diversion, if occasional, but do they have to be mandatory? Couldn't we just have the Doctor turning up on a planet, finding a monster, and then, after some wisecracking and japes, killing it?
It's all still waiting for you.
Uh-huh.
The fields of Trenzalore, the fall of the 11th, and the question.
No questions. Is it too much to ask for just one season at least, without a build-up to a finale that makes dubious sense? Or would that mean...
Nothing.
Nothing? You mean nothing will happen to me?
Nothing at all. Ever.
Number 45. Doctor Who Lives.
On the 26th of March 2005, a little before 7 p.m, and in just three simple words, I put a voice to the nation's hopes. Hello, I'm John Peake, Editor-in-Chief of Britain's best-selling magazine, TV Choice, and also Total TV Guide. 8 years ago, and a couple of weeks before that date in March, I travelled to Cardiff along with the rest of the TV journalism industry for a preview screening of the brand new Doctor Who television series. Not being a huge fan, it was exciting nonetheless. Held at Cardiff's brutalist St David's Hotel, it was a posh affair. The pre-screening drinks reception was a sea of miniature TARDIS lamps. I did consider popping one into my man bag, but they were practically screwed down. The eBay benefits of the first Doctor Who series in 16 years were not to be underestimated. Billy Piper mingled, Eccleston didn't. When it was time for the screening, you could have cut the atmosphere with a knife, as Russell T Davies and Mal Young did their intros. The excitement was beyond palpable. Then, as the lights dimmed and the familiar music started, I'm sure I heard fanboys sniffling with blessed relief as their beloved show was reborn. Even I felt a frisson. This was a bit of TV history after all, no matter what the outcome. The mood following the screening was buoyant. The after-show do was awash with local celebrity colour, like Charlotte Church, who told us she wasn't doing any autographs that night. But I did get to shake hands with Eccleston, now that most elusive of doctors. This show was going to be a hit, I was sure of it. And then I spoke those words.
Yeah, that's all gone now. Doctor Who Lives.
Yes, Doctor Who Lives. I shot a look straight down the camera lens when I said that. A fortnight later, the BBC used that soundbite at the climax of their documentary, Doctor Who: A New Dimension, which preceded the premiere of Christopher Eccleston's first episode. As a result, I was subsequently sent a special DVD box set of the first series of Doctor Who Confidential. It's still shrink-wrapped, and yes, I'd consider bids on it. Plus, at a subsequent press launch, Russell T himself told me I was now canon. The following year, my services were called upon again for another Doctor Who documentary, which aired before David Tennant's first regular episode, an episode my notes tell me was entitled New Earth. I was less sure-footed on this occasion. It had been another fun press night for Doctor Who, but I was a little in drink, with my hair a bit too much like Dr. Hilary Jones, and I was feeling the pressure of trying to come up with something memorably succinct. This is what I said.
Great casting, really good special effects. It knocked all the old series into a cot hat, really.
Well, I've never been asked back, and I haven't taken receipt of any more box sets, and TV Cream were quite mean to me about it in their Cream Guide emails. But Russell, dear Russell T, he didn't forget me, and I was delighted to be mentioned in passing in 2008 in that column he did for Doctor Who magazine. And so for me, Doctor Who still lives.
Doctor Who still lives. Doctor Who still lives. Still lives.
Number 44, The Pod Complex.
Hi, I'm not Chip, although I sound like him, and this isn't the 2-Minute Time Lord podcast. In fact, this isn't even the right theme tune. It's like one of those copyright-avoiding knockoffs you get on Russ Abbott's Basildon Bond sketches. You know, the man with the golden Labrador, for example. Look, we've barely started and I can tell you're already confused. So for the purposes of the next few minutes, think of me as Professor Judson to TV Cream's Finric. Or if that reference doesn't make sense to you, how about Posh Paws to TV Cream's John Craven? No? Well, basically what I'm trying to say is that those arbiters of the right kind of nostalgia have commandeered my voice to help them celebrate Doctor Who podcasting. And who better to speak on that subject, you might ask, than one of our most preeminent podcasters? Hey, that's not me saying that. Remember, this is TV Cream talking. Boy, okay, this is getting confusing. As confusing as trying to work out the correct order in which Brooks, Stableford, and Jones presented Beat the Teacher. But I digress. It's TV Cream's view that podcasting might just be the best communication medium ever invented for fans. It requires little of the production know-how needed to pull together a fanzine, but it does force its communicators to be accountable in a way that precludes the kind of troll-like behavior hidden behind anonymity you can all too often find on the internet. Podcasting also offers up the perfect balance of immediacy versus reflection. When the news of Peter Capaldi's casting was announced by Zoe Ball, daughter of Think of a Number's Johnny Ball, what a handsome chap, the Skype waves lit up with podcasters coming together to offer up their not-quite-instant reactions. Not quite, because unlike other social media outlets, with podcasting there is a healthy and necessary delay between voicing your opinion and having it become available for download. That gap negates the knee-jerk desire to be first out of the traps with something to say, and so encourages a little reflection, which in turn brings about better opinionating. Of course, Doctor Who podcasts come in all shapes and sizes, from those that can't help but poke a little gentle fun at their fellow nerds, to those that assiduously dissect Holmesian double acts and wrestle with what the canonical fallout would have been had Doctor Who magazine taken up Russell T. Davies' offer to let them regenerate the comic strip Eighth Doctor into Christopher Eccleston. Some podcasts are long, some last just 2 minutes. Heck, some even feature actual females. I know, who would have thunk it? But every single podcast has one thing in common. They drink too much, smoke too much, and should never go gunning for one man. Oh no, wait, that's Robbie Box in Big Deal. Oh well, that wasn't your 2MTL for TV Cream Countdown. And this is Chip, wishing you happy times and places. Big Deal. Man, I loved that show. And Pipkins, not forgetting Hardwick House, and 5 to 11, and Roy J., the Slither Spook Man, and that show with the pylons, and the Glens, Hutchinsons, Robertsons, and Stepak ads on STV. Those were just awesome!
Number 43. Ah.
Hello? 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 Hello, who is this?
Yes, my who? Dears. Hello.
I'm sorry, what are you saying? What?
Well, don't you recognize me?
You sound like someone who rings people up doing a bad impression of Tom Baker.
Well, how did you know?
Because you're somebody doing a bad impression of Tom Baker.
Well, you see, it's so very simple, really.
Is that so?
Yes. You see, it can work on so many levels.
Yeah, well, I can only really count one.
Really?
Yes, going and saying really.
Oh,
yes.
Really?
Am I meant to be impressed?
Yes, my dear, yes.
Look, anyone can do impressions of Doctor Who.
I know, well, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, well, I grant you, he is someone who does lend himself rather pleasingly to caricature.
And so effortlessly, my dears.
Really?
Well, really, I mean, this was just...
Well, I always thought the Daleks were the easiest to impersonate, sure.
No, anyone can do them,
But you're saying, well, it takes a special someone to impersonate Doctor Who.
Well, possibly.
Someone like you, presumably.
Oh, no, it's a gift. my dear. It's a gift that we all share.
What, the gift of being intensely annoying?
Oh, no, the gift of mimicry. Ah, who's this?
Well, that's Doctor Who again.
Yes, my child. Yes, but a very different doctor indeed.
Yes. Yes, one that seems to mostly say,
Well,
No, you mean,
No, that's the other one.
Can you do any others?
Well, there's John Pertwee. Remarkably persistent, aren't they?
That's just doing a busybody voice.
Lower it a bit, and you get Peter Davison. An apple a day keeps the, yes.
Well, that's just someone sounding harassed.
But that's the beauty of it. They're all archetypes.
Well, true.
Well, apart from Colin Baker.
Well, he just sounded...
Like what, exactly?
Not very friendly.
I am known as the Doctor.
Yes, and I am known to get irritated by people who don't respect archetypes.
Archie who?
Oh, piss off, I don't want this voice.
How about this one?
Who's that?
David Tennant.
Oh, go away.
I don't want to go.
None of these impressions have been any good.
Well, they're only impressions, my dear. Would you like me to do K-9?
I can do K-9. K-9! K-9!
Oh, I say, that's really rather good.
Oh, do you think so?
Well, it's almost as good as the original.
Oh, well, I don't know. I mean,
Can you do any more?
Okay, who's this? The lady's not for turning.
Alas, I never watched that.
I'm sorry?
Blake 7, I couldn't bear it.
What? No, no. Oh, never mind.
Oh, well, who's this? Now, I've had a letter here from a young lady who says to me, Dear Jim...
No, you can't do that impression anymore.
Can you guess what it is yet?
Nor that one. Look, I think I better hang up.
It's the end.
Don't say it.
But the moment has been prepared for...
Goodbye.
Number 42. A complete character.
Welcome to Blue Peter, Doctors 1 and 5.
If there's one thing that Doctor Who fans are resolutely not divided on, it's Richard Herndall, the actor who did a creditable job of standing in for William Hartnell in the 20th anniversary story The Five Doctors, but nothing greater or lesser than that. If you're looking for the dictionary definition of damning with faint praise, look no further than the DVD extras for The Five Doctors, wherein erstwhile series regular Mark Strickson straights through visibly gritted teeth that with Herndall you got, quote, a complete character. Part of the reason for all this might well be down to his, shall we say, unique take on the idea of tying promotional appearances, which managed to bewilder cast, band and production team alike in equal measure. Take, for example, the lengthy plug for The Five Doctors on Blue Peter, wherein Herndall and Peter Davison show up in studio, and in costume, for a chat with the presenters and pets. Davison, as ever, is witty, laconic, and very intentionally appearing as himself, just happening to be wearing an awful coat that casual viewers might just recognise him for.
It's a bit of a change from the TARDIS, isn't it, this?
Yes, it is.
But who will be actually using the minibus?
It's the children of the Gurney School in the East End, and there are about 100 of them. They'll be using it for day outings, you know, visits to Doctor Who exhibitions, things like that.
Herndall, on the other hand, appears to be doing the whole thing in character, only it's in character as a former couldn't-give-flying-fuck viewer's casual recollection of a very bad impressionist idea of William Hartnell, circa about 2 years after he'd actually left the programme. He opens with a wince-inducing exclamation of,
"Welcome to you from the Time Lord!"
suggesting that he'd not only misunderstood the entire history of the programme ever, but had also somehow managed to misunderstand the script he'd actually just performed to camera, and all of this is the visible bafflement of everyone else present.
Wonderful. Is there going to be a special presentation ceremony?
Oh, yes, indeed there is. Tomorrow morning.
Oh, that's marvellous. I'm sure the children will be absolutely thrilled.
Still, at least it was a complete character, and it was better than using a ham-faced blue-haired digital patch-in.
Now then, which of you will destroy the aliens in the 20th anniversary programme?
I will.
We will. I see. It's the old problem. You'll just have to watch on Friday night to find out.
And at number 41, Splinks.
If you have any problems with your favourite games, drop us a line about them and we'll get your queries answered by the man who knows more than anyone, the Games Master.
Hello, Games Master.
Welcome to my kingdom. I am delighted to see you. And what have you got to ask?
In Doctor Who, the First Adventure, I've managed to get past the Labyrinth of Death, which is a bit like Pac-Man, and I've got past the Pterodactyls, which were a bit like Frogger, but I can't locate the invisible monsters when I get to the Box of Tantalus level, which is a bit like battleships. Please help.
Doctor Who has always had an unhappy history when it comes to computer games. Sure, the downloads you can now get from the BBC website are okay, but the Time Lord's recent exploits on PlayStation and Nintendo DS have all been rubbish. However, there was one crossover into the world of pixelated peril that made all the needless keyboard thumping and joystick waggling worthwhile. But before we get to that, a bit of backstory. It was in 1983 that Doctor Who first appeared in computer game form. Released by BBC Micro and sporting the perfunctory title of Doctor Who The First Adventure, everything about this was resolutely basic, and indeed BBC basic, as in the programming language. In fact, the only thing notable about this game was the Doctor's ability to regenerate, 15 times.
Feels different this time.
Yeah, bet it does. 3 years later came another effort from BBC Micro, trumpeted in glorious fashion one Saturday morning on BBC One after a screening of Peter Cushing in an exciting adventure with the Daleks.
There's a challenging adventure game for use with the BBC Micro computer called Doctor Who and the Warlord, with over 250 locations in each part, and a useful save and retrieve facility to enable you to save and load your last position, and the cassette costs £7.95.
Save and retrieve facility, that was a big deal back then. More exciting was a rival offering, The Minds of Terror, in which the Colin Baker Doctor Who was joined by a robotic cat called Splinks.
Splink?
No, John, you're not listening. Splinks.
Did I hear somebody say Splink?
No, you didn't.
Splink?
You're not helping. The Minds of Terror's other selling point was its inclusion of a race of non-specific, dustbin-like patrolling robots that in no way infringed upon any intellectual property held by the Terry Nation estate. But the Daleks, who clearly I was alluding to there, wouldn't be denied for long, and in 1992 they headlined their own game, Dalek Attack. It was available on all platforms, ZX Spectrum, Commodore 64, Atari ST, although not Amstrad, and you could play as the 4th, 5th or 7th Doctor, but not the 6th, probably because of colour clash issues. Then, in 1997, we finally got a Doctor Who game of merit. Destiny of the Doctors, released for PC, featured brand new footage of Anthony Ainley as the Master and a script by Terence Dix. The results, predictably, were brilliant.
Mighty Orb. Planet of pure mental energy. I, the Master, have harnessed the majesty of your psychic intellect and made you my puppet.
Granted, the gameplay wasn't up to much. It saw you taking on the guise of a turquoise jellyfish called the Grark, floating endlessly around corridors and confronting crappy, polygony versions of Doctor Who baddies. But it was all worth it for this bit, the Master's unexpectedly excellent summation of the seven faces of Doctor Who, as he rifled through each incarnation in reverse order. To be honest, it's so good, we're just going to play it in full.
Bring forth the Doctor! Ah, the most recent! One so busy setting plans and traps that he fails to see those set for him. Oh, look, the blustering one in the stupid coat. How he struts and gloats. Wait, there's the nice one. Such charm, such innocence, such naivety, such a fool. The bohemian, the wanderer. One so keen to abandon his roots that he abandoned his sense. Now, there was a worthy foe. Such cunning, such ingenuity. All wasted through that stubborn streak of goodness. The comedian! But a capable comedian, too. Not quite the clown he looks, this one. There's the first. Such wisdom, such intellect. But oh, what a bore the fellow was.
Yes, there's that Homo sapiens speech, or the one about the Pandorica. But this, well, this really gets to the dual beating hearts of Doctor Who. And for that reason, Dominic, do you want to step forward and make our special presentation to Destiny of the Doctors?
We'd like to award you a special coveted Golden Games Master joystick.
Deservedly so. So, any plans for tonight, Dom?
Well, now it's time for me to don my smoking jacket and have a refreshing cup of chamomile.
Oh, okay then.
Enough! Enough peddling. I, the master, grow weary of this encomium. And so I throw my cape over the first episode of TV Cream Countdown, the 50 greatest Doctor Who moments. But I fear that there is more to come next time.
What Paris has, it has an ethos, a life.
I don't know. I always wanted to come to one, and thought, why not?
How very convenient, isn't it? That whenever the TARDIS malfunctions, it always materializes just when there's a crisis going.
AD, the year when human beings are turned into living dead men, robo-men, the underground slaves of the world's new dictators.
As for me, I'm setting my TARDIS coordinates for early October 2013, where I intend to wreak havoc upon the BBC's plans to announce the return of a cache of missing Patrick Troughton episodes. Delightful devilishness. Goodbye!